I have been very much looking forward to a conversation with Professor John Norton Moore, the Walter L. Brown Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. He also directs the University Center for National Security Law and the Center for Oceans Law and Policy, and was the director of the graduate law program at UVA for more than 20 years. He is a former member of the U.S. State Department, where he was an ambassador. We'll learn more about that, and we will talk about the new book that he has edited about the presidential debates, issues, and questions for the 2016 elections and beyond. Ambassador Moore, welcome to the program. I am so glad you are here.
Coy, thank you so much. It's a privilege and a pleasure to be here. Let me at the outset indicate that though I'm a professor at the University of Virginia, the views expressed are my personal views only.
We've got a book here before us that looks at the real issues that we should be talking about as Americans this year, instead of so much of the bread and circuses that we are given and the sideshow and the carnival. And that's what we're going to do in this hour. We're going to really talk in depth about the issues and the questions that we should be putting before Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and anyone who steps up and says, I believe I can lead America. But before we do, before we get there, are the debates still important, the presidential debates? And where did your interest specifically in the debates come from? And what should we understand about the debates? We're only a few weeks out from the first one. The world will be watching that debate. What should we understand about it?
Thank you so much, Coy, for getting to the right issues instead of the bread and circus surrounding the debates. They're enormously important, but unfortunately, what we have seen so far in this presidential cycle in both parties, and I would anticipate as well, but hope not, but would anticipate also the two-party presidential debate, more in the bread and circus and insult routine as opposed to the actual analysis of fundamental issues facing the country that are enormously important that we need to be talking about so that voters can really make up their minds based on the policy issues and how the candidates deal with them.
Before we get into some of those specific issues and start talking about them, including, you know, immigration, defense and foreign policy, criminal justice reform, the wealth gap, lots to talk about. But before we do, you have been appointed to positions by a number of Republican administrations, number of Republican U.S. presidents. You have been long a member of the GOP and voted Republican. What crosses your mind this year when you look at the supposed standard bearer of your party, the nominee of your party, is Donald Trump?
I'm terribly troubled this year, not only at the very bad debates and the very bad process for selecting the president, but by my own candidate, which I will not be able to support. I believe very, very sadly that the candidate this year does not represent Republican values, and that he is not qualified to be the commander-in-chief of the United States. And I find it extremely difficult and troubling as a Republican to have to take that position publicly.
But have we been here before? Have Republicans, because I can remember some of this kind of conversation when I read my history, there was a lot of these same kind of things being said by Republicans when Goldwater was nominated in 64. He's from the margins, that radical right-wing part of the party, and he's bringing all the Birchers in with him, and there was a real struggle. How can I support Goldwater, and then what does the party do after Goldwater? Or is there something about Trump that's different?
This is fundamentally different this time than anything we've seen before. If we're looking at the qualifications, for example, for commander-in-chief, we need emotional stability and good judgment. What we see in a candidate basically that simply seeks to strike out with crude personal insults in response to perceived slights, even when it is harmful, and has to be known to be harmful for his candidacy, shows extremely bad judgment. Sadly, we need yet another very important issue of trustworthiness and integrity. And when we have a setting that a candidate refuses to release his tax returns, a candidate who, when he talks cavalierly about how we might handle the national debt, simply throws out, well, maybe we ought to simply default on our Treasury bonds and basically be completely counter to Alexander Hamilton and the good faith and credit of the United States of America. We need a candidate who understands foreign and national security policy. When we have a candidate who basically publicly states that perhaps we should not live up to our obligations in NATO to protect from the Russians today, the Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, for example, we have a very serious problem. When we have a candidate who in terms of his knowledge of nuclear proliferation, suggests that it might be a good thing for South Korea and Japan to get nuclear weapons, this is a very, very dangerous setting and complete ignorance. We need a candidate that understands something about the United States Constitution and the rule of law and fundamentals of how our system works. And so far, from what I've seen in terms of the candidate's statements, sadly, he seems woefully ignorant as to the United States Constitution. One of my favorite malapropisms of the candidate most recently is when asked whether he would protect the crucial Article 1, which is Congress, of course, and Article 2, the executive branch, provisions of the Constitution, he basically volunteered that he would respect the non-existent Article 12 of the United States Constitution. So I think we unfortunately have a setting that we have never faced before, in which one of the candidates of a major party is woefully unqualified to be president of the United States, and as a result is opposed by many of the staunchest supporters of that party, and I'm one of those.
And it's interesting as well that that Steve Bannon, who came in from Breitbart to run his campaign, has said publicly, I'm not a conservative. I don't believe in the traditional conservatism of the Republican Party. We are the alt-right, they call themselves, which is not conservatism and is more, frankly, it really picks up where the Birchers left off. And it's like when you listen to them, it's like being at a John Birch Society meeting in 1962. I think it's alarming that this white, national, really angry populism these flames are being fanned.
The level of bigotry that has been suggested by the anti-immigrant remarks and the attack against the United States federal judge of Mexican heritage and a variety of other issues are extremely troubling. And the reality is we have no idea what the views of this man are. He has, according to the Washington Post, changed his political party 7 times in 13 years. So why is it that I should believe he is a Republican? He certainly doesn't support, as far as I can tell, the values of Lincoln or the values of the fundamental framers of this Constitution, who understood that the rule of law is critical and that we needed a Constitution based on checks and balances to protect us generally. Let me also just throw in yet another statement of the candidate that I regard as extremely dangerous in relation to the kind of way he might seek to govern and his setting aside of the Constitution of the United States. Basically, when he was asked about how you would basically govern and should we set aside the institutions of government generally, basically suggested, well, you do it through political contributions to candidates from both parties to, quote, have them do whatever the hell you want, end quote. That is not the rule of law. That is not the principles of the framers of the United States Constitution. So,
but it's how an oligarch thinks. You know, I'm going to buy what I want in the world because I can afford it. And if you can't, well, then too bad for you.
Very troubling. Also, statements being made that seem to threaten First Amendment libel issues, that seem to threaten religious freedom. Now, again, we're going to be talking in a few minutes about some very solid conservative principles that I fundamentally believe are the right ones for the country. They are conservative. They are the Republican principles. I support those. I will be supporting in the strongest way every Republican candidate for the Senate and the House and the Congress of the United States. Indeed, my own view is it's extremely important at this point, if we're going to deal with a deficit, if we're going to get rid of the tax and spend policies that are out of control in Washington, we need Republican continuing control of the Congress of the United States. And so I firmly anticipate that the next president of the United States will be Clinton, and that we need a mixed government going forward that will have a Republican Congress.
John, let's dig into some of these issues that you have identified in this work that are the absolute critical issues that we as American citizens should be focused on, should be thinking about, and honestly, should be pushing our leaders to be focusing on and to thinking about. And it's easy to see when they get off course and they stop focusing on these things, but you have a list here of seven things that you have identified, and really quick, economic growth, the wealth gap, criminal justice reform, reducing crime, the treating disease and public health, and then, of course, at the end, defense and foreign policy and immigration reform. Let's start with the economy. We hear this all the time, that it's all about the economy, and our leaders do talk about the economy, but are they talking about it in the kind of way that you would like to see?
Not very usefully, Coy, and I think you're now getting at the kind of things we really ought to see seriously in the presidential debates. There are differing views about these things, and it's appropriate that we have differing views reflected from the candidates, but we need to have them that focus actually on the important issues. The first is to really understand that the number one issue really facing the country is how do we restore economic growth? We've been rocking along at a miserable 2% a year now since about 2008. Indeed, the first half of this year was only an anemic 1% a year rate. If you increase the growth rate of the country from 2 to 4% over a 25-year period, that's only 2 to 4% in that period of time, in the aggregate, the country at the end of 25 years will be 62% wealthier than it would be otherwise. If you go simply from 2 to 3% for a 25-year period, the country in the aggregate will be 27% wealthier than it would be otherwise. Growth rates affect everything. The amount of money the government has in relation to dealing with criminal justice reform, the military, defense, education, targeting disease, it all depends on robust growth. For this book, I put together 12 of the country's top experts. There's a marvelous chapter in there by John Cochran of Hoover, one of the greatest experts in the country on how do we get growth going. But basically, this is an area in which we do need to reduce taxes, not increase taxes. Taxes are already much too high. There is a mythology that taxes somehow are low, and yet, according to the Internal Revenue Service itself, its own data, in 2012, the top 1% of taxpayers in the United States paid 38% of the entire income tax. The top 10% of taxpayers in the United States paid the top 70% of the United States income tax. So part of it is we have to get taxes down and the corporate tax rate down in order to encourage growth as one of the elements there. The second is regulatory reform. And there are a number of things that I'm proposing in relation to regulatory reform. One is that the new administration, and I think a Democratic administration could do this as well as a Republican administration, it should look very carefully at all of these first-generation laws, regulatory structures that we have on the books, look at those that have the greatest cost associated with them, and look at whether a move to second-generation regulatory, much more effective laws might be a more useful way to go. But there are a number of other kinds of things we can do as well. We need to enhance women's access to jobs and women's rights, getting women into the workforce regularly and protecting their workplace rights is extremely important. And there are a number of others that should all be put together in trying to move growth forward. But that's the number one issue. Everything else ties into that. And so much of the discussion should be about how do we get the country moving in growth.
Is it correct to say, you think, John, that the problem was that we lost the manufacturing base? That has become sort of a shorthand in political circles. Well, you know, America would be strong if we made stuff again. And we grew the middle class on that the crux of the fact that that America, that blue-collar America, that we had a blue-collar America, was engaged in making things and shipping things out to the rest of the world that the world wanted, and that produced, it made it possible for somebody who had a high school degree to raise a family in a nice home in a nice neighborhood and send your kids to school. Charlottesville was built on a manufacturing economy following the Civil War. We had a pencil factory. We had the Ix mill. We had the woolen mills. I mean, the neighborhoods grew up around this manufacturing base. But if you look at the history of capitalism, production will always go, it always has, where it can find the cheapest labor. I mean, that's one reason those factories were here after the Civil War, because that's where the cheap labor was in a destroyed Confederacy, eager for jobs. And then they went to Mexico and India and China, and they roam around the globe looking for cheap labor. So I don't fault capitalism for that. It's doing what it's exactly supposed to do. But what's your perspective on that, that America needs to recapture that? And you have people like Trump who are out there saying, well, I'm going to bring the jobs back. And any sensible person knows he's not going to bring those jobs back.
There is a problem in getting adequate jobs for people and training for the appropriate skills that are needed in the workplace. I can understand where the populism is coming from that leads, on the one hand, to a Sanders, basically scapegoating trade and scapegoating Wall Street, and to a Trump on the other side, basically scapegoating trade and scapegoating immigrants. The reality, I think, is a little different economically. The United States is producing more in manufacturing today, as I understand it, than it ever has in the history of the country before. In the aggregate, trade has been good for the United States and will continue to be good for the United States. And it is unfortunate that even in the Democratic side, you've seen these attacks, and on the Republican side, attacking the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, for example. Now, I do think that we can negotiate tougher in relation to the non-tariff barriers. I think we are being taken advantage of on some of those. But we need to be looking at other ways to bring people and their skills into the current environment where we have the advantage in the world, where we have the greatest productivity in the world. Much of it in, you know, relating to internet and cyber issues and many others. And so we're also good in manufacturing when we get appropriate manufacturing base and the right tools.
It's a good point to make, because people usually don't understand that we're actually making more stuff than we did when we thought we were making stuff, that we are still a country that makes stuff and manufactures stuff. They've just figured out how to do it with far less people. That is one of the challenges with automation and the economies of scale, that we have truly figured out how to make a lot of stuff with much less people involved in the process.
I think you're absolutely right. The technology, the advancing technology that to some extent puts some people out of work while creating jobs for others, is more of a problem in the aggregate in jobs, I think, certainly than anything related to trade. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't in certain settings, in trade settings and in automation settings, things that put a large number of people out of work very painfully and that we ought to be looking at very carefully as to how you make appropriate adjustments and how you provide assistance and the skills base to move to other other jobs.
And the automation you mentioned is a key that everyone should be watching and should be on everyone's radar, because we've lived through a period where we've seen blue-collar workers dislocated from the economy, is a way to put it, because of automation. And what we're absolutely going to see moving forward, we're going to see lawyers, we're going to see doctors, bankers. We're going to start to see white-collar workers who've been dislocated because of automation. They're going to figure out ways, and they already are, figuring out ways to bring artificial intelligence and automation to a lot of these white-collar jobs. That's coming faster than we even realize.
Global competition is real. The problem with the populist approaches that we're hearing are basically that somehow you're going to deal with this by insulating yourself from the rest of the world. You don't. You have to engage in the globalism and win. And the United States is one of the most productive countries in the world, some of the most productive workers. We're perfectly able to do that. I think yet another problem, frankly, with the current administration is that there has been kind of an anti-business rhetoric, sort of a notion that business people are bad and that somehow they don't deserve the fruits of their labor. And I think
that feeds the populism of the left, just like Donald Trump's anti-immigrants feeds the populism on the
absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. And I think that's part of the this malaise in which American business, with huge amounts of money on the books to make investment, are not investing at present. This is one of the problems. And so I think what economists talk about in relation to sort of the popular sentiment and sort of the sense of business leaders, or do they feel confident, is an extremely important part of why our growth rate is as low as it is today.
Well, and part of the problem is that the fact that it's not that corporate America isn't making money. They're making tons of money. And their executives and the oligarchs in this country are profiting enormously. But they're parking all the money overseas. You know, it's the way they set up in the corporate global world, where you can have a subsidiary of a subsidiary of a subsidiary, and you expense your expenses on the American books and write them off, but you show your profits on the books of Ecuador or the Bahamas or wherever, and the money's not staying in our economy.
Well, we're partly creating that problem by having some of the highest corporate income tax rates in the world. Our rates are primarily around 35%. With state taxes can run to 40 or 45%, as opposed to, let's say, Ireland, that's around 12%. Now, the world is a real world. It's a global system out there, and people are going to go where the tax rates are somewhat less expensive. You can bring that money back by simply providing some way of dealing with otherwise what is double taxation for those companies that are involved. Apple, for example, has been attacked in this, and yet over the weekend there was a very interesting analysis in the Washington Post that basically shows that much of that was a false attack on Apple as a tax avoider. But this also gets to something I think that's very important for us to talk about, which is the wealth gap and the deficit. The deficit of the United States is extremely important. One of my greatest concerns as a Republican is that we are heading toward a setting in which we will continue an out-of-control tax and spend setting. We are generating deficits that simply are not sustainable through a variety of entitlement programs. We have to get them under control. Now, I believe there is one bit of low-hanging fruit out there that not only works to dramatically reduce government spending, but is one of the most effective ways to deal with a wealth gap of anything we have out there. It's called Social Security optionality. Basically, what this does is say that anyone 40 or younger has the option to select a Social Security system that would be comparable, let's say, to the sort of governmental programs that all the members of Congress have, or that those of us in the academic community have in TIAA-CREF, that return 5 and 6% over the year simply because they're normally invested. They are normal investment systems, whereas Social Security system is not. And it's going to be producing for the current generation of American workers about a 1% to a minus 1% return on the money they put into the system. That's a disgrace. We need a Social Security system. Reforming Social Security is not simply a matter of making a few changes at the edges, which we can easily do to keep it solvent in terms of cutting down the when you can retire and things of this sort.
Sure, sure.
That's not what it's about. The great disaster of the existing Social Security system is its returns are virtually nil. And we can take, for example, by using this optionality approach, not changing anybody's Social Security that doesn't want it changed. But younger people, 40 and under, that would like to make a change, a blue-collar worker starting out, let's say a two-income family, can at the end of a period of a lifetime have an estate of approximately $1 million or more at normal returns. That is not anything unusual in terms of normal retirement systems in hospitals, in universities, and in the United States government.
So what's your response, though, to somebody who listened to that, what you say is low-hanging fruit optional suggestion, and says, oh, that's privatizing Social Security. That's just going to make Wall Street wealthy through through fees, and they're going to take my money, and I'm going to end up with less than what I would get if I just stayed with a regular government plan, and this is just a gift to Wall Street.
Well, this is one of the false arguments that's made against Social Security optionality. Let me tell you why it's false. The reason that it's false is the difference between 1% or minus 1% and plus 6% is so great that we can easily add, for those opting for optionality, a governmental guarantee that will give them no less than they would get in the current Social Security system.
Then that's a key to understanding it. You
right.
can opt to put your money to work
exactly.
for you, invest it
exactly.
with the understanding that you would get no less.
No less than what you would get in the current Social Security system, and that's a slam dunk. That's easy to do. We're talking about investment horizons over a 30, 40, 50-year period of time. And by the way, it should be structured so that they're able, if they die earlier and don't need all of that for retirement, they should be able, with tax-free, to transfer it to their families. There are really basically two ways to empower working Americans in terms of giving them some funds to basically nationally deal with a wealth gap. One is buying your own home. That's fine as long as you're getting prices of houses going up.
As long as you get your money out of it one day, yeah.
and as long as you're fortunate enough to be able today in a tough environment to have the down payment and all the rest. So even that's problematic as to how many people are going to be able to afford that today. But the second is something we can do for everyone. All younger people in America today, 40 and under, could be offered an optionality. And frankly, this is one of the great mistakes of the Democratic Party. They rail against this as Social Security privatization, and they are harming the working class of the United States enormously by doing so. The kinds of figures that I'm talking about are things that are affirmed by the Social Security actuaries themselves. And we have a very good chapter in the book written by the top expert on this. Other countries have adopted it. It works beautifully.
Well, even if you just put it in a target retirement account at Vanguard, you're going to be better off.
You've got it. Yeah. That's exactly it. That's all it is.
So what do you think about, I've been inspired by the work of economist Dr. Michael Hudson, who writes often about the FIRE economy, the F-I-R-E, finance, insurance, and real estate, and how one of the challenges we have with our economy is the fact that it's been set up in such a way that it relies so much on debt service, whether it's an individual who's paying debt service or a municipality or the government, that so much of the money we spend goes into servicing existing debt. And the ones who get rich off of that are in the finance industry, the insurance industry, and real estate. And it tends to laser focus the profits into those industries, which is why we've seen the fortunes we've seen in those industries. I mean, unbelievable fortunes. And this speaks to your wealth gap, that fortunes that we didn't even see anything close to this during the late 19th century in America. And when, you know, this great period in America, when there was such a wealth gap, we far surpassed that in the 21st century. And what is the concern, as a conservative, what do you see as the long-term threat to the health of a nation and of a citizenry of a runaway wealth gap, where you have an increasing number of very unbelievably wealthy few, and the masses become the working poor?
Well, I think we need very seriously to address the wealth gap, but we don't do it. We will not do it successfully by basically seeking to take from those that are working hard and earning it. We want a good tax system that basically taxes them adequately. But the idea that the top 10% of those paying income taxes somehow, you know, paying 70% of the system into income tax is too low. That's not the solution. The solution is we need to work more effectively in ways to let people own their own homes, but not do it as we did in the past with ignoring some of the financial implications that really ended up harming people dramatically when they had to be foreclosed on. But the most important, the true low-hanging fruit that's right there that can make millionaires in their lifetime of the blue-collar working American is Social Security optionality. It's right there for both parties to do. All it takes is some courage and understanding of the issue on it. But some of the other things you point out, there are things we can change in the tax code, for example, to encourage equity. One of those would be a reduction in the rate on dividends and capital gains. And I don't believe personally that it ought to be higher than 15% on long-term capital gains and dividends. That would encourage equity financing a little more than going into the debts, because the debts are fully deductible by the corporation. But they pay taxes on all their profits, which then before they go to dividends, or give them a deduction on their dividends before they pay the dividends out, if you want to do that. So there are many things we can do. But there are a lot of other issues, Coy.
Yeah, I want to ask you about, just to remind people, we're talking with John Norton Moore of the UVA School of Law, and the new book is The Presidential Debates. And we're looking very closely at some of these key issues that we should be hearing the Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump discussing in depth. Just to change gears here, the next thing on our list is criminal justice reform. What needs to happen there? What can you, because I think on the right and the left, we realize that we have an incredibly broken system, and we have such inertia in the system, as we were talking before we went on the air. We have an entire system that is so risk averse that it's like everybody's afraid to make any kind of move, even though they know what are the best practices that we're not doing, and they know that change needs to happen if we want to move this country closer to its ideals, if we want to truly have justice in America for everyone, not just the wealthy.
Absolutely, and the good news here is that there is a general consensus on both left and right, both Democratic and Republican side, that we need to look very seriously at criminal justice reform. The root of the problem is that we have about 5% of the population of the world, and yet we have in the United States, in state and federal prisons together, approximately 25% of the total incarcerated in the world. Now, for the world's greatest democracy, which we are, and which we certainly aspire to continue to be, that's an absolute scandal. This is a shocker.
We should be ashamed. We're the world's jailer. There's no reason for that. And the vast majority of them are people of color and are poor.
And some of the things we need to do in here, one is to look much more carefully at the sentencing guidelines and to have a complete review. I understand why, in many respects, we were looking at them to have these congressional mandates, to try to have fairness in the way they applied across the board. but they're too tough for the most part. There may be some that are too loose, but mostly they're too tough. The second is we're still using incarceration much too much for nonviolent crimes. Someone running a Ponzi scheme out of Wall Street needs to have some hard time done. But there's all kinds of stuff that is not violent crime, that there are other ways of dealing with the issue other than incarceration. And I think we need to be looking at that. We need to be looking at early release programs in terms of some of the things the state of Texas has done, for example, and that other countries are doing that seem very, very helpful. So there are many things that we can do, but we need a very, very thoroughgoing, careful review of those issues. Now, this is related to the problem of reducing crime. We still have too much crime. We need to reduce crime. And the approach of basically solving crime by increasing the penalties or putting larger numbers of people in jail does not seem to have solved the problem.
And I think that was the conservative mantra, though, John. For years, it was what all we heard from Republicans was get tough on crime and three strikes and you're out. And the implication and the direct lesson being that the cure to crime is prison.
I would argue it was the political mantra, not just the Republican mantra. You heard it from the Democratic side.
Fair enough.
Well.
Yes, indeed.
And it came from both. But in any event, I think there's a far better approach to some of the newer things we know that might be quite effective in reducing crime. And what I'm recommending in the book, and we have several excellent chapters, one is in the old days you learned not to commit crime really from your family, the strength of the family and the moral values you got. With the collapse of the family, sadly, to some extent, and one of the things we ought to be doing is trying to strengthen family structure in many, many ways, and our tax laws are bad with that. But one of the things that we need to do is look at how do we instill those values in people. And I think the answer to that that has worked extremely well in a number of other countries that have tried it is putting very effective rule of law and education against crime and education against drug programs in the public schools. We have not done that seriously in America, and we need to do it, and have a wonderful chapter in there by Dr. Roy Godson, who's the world's expert basically showing how this works abroad.
No, we've been using the old approach of prisons as the solution.
That's right.
That's gotten down into the schools, and now we have the schools to prison pipeline, where you know a kid who, you know, in your day or in my day, when you act up, you would go to the principal, you get a talking to, and Lord forbid your dad finds out about it, then you go home. Now the police come and they put you in shackles. I mean, we had the case up in Greene County where a kindergartner was shackled and taken to the sheriff's department for acting up in class.
You want very sophisticated educational programs starting at the right age in the school, and I'm not the educational expert to know what you do where, but at some point, one of the things you have is that little indication of here's the lifestyle of the drug dealer and looking pretty good right now. You know, there he is in the convertible, but there he is 3 months from now lying dead or going into federal prison for the next 40 years. And here, on the other hand, is the working man that basically becomes superb as a plumber. And here he is 40 years from now. He and his wife are going fishing. You know, they got two cars. They've got their own fishing boat, and things are looking pretty good, and they've got their kids. And so you've got to educate people not just on the moral basis, which is critical, but also on the sort of the ego integrity basis, as psychologists would say, of why it's a stupid life choice to go into crime. And so one of the things we can do is get much better in doing that in the school system. Now, there's a second thing we can do that I think relates to, sadly, some of the things we've seen in Ferguson and Baltimore. We need to encourage far greater relational policing, as the wonderful police chief of this city, Chief Longo, called it. Some call it community policing. But it's the idea that we are not just working basically to train citizens in rule of law, but we are also working to integrate the police much more effectively into the neighborhoods that they're working with. I think there's much to be said for the old walking on the beat that knows the policeman on the beat that knows the people. Maybe that's not the perfect way to do relational policing today, but we need to be reaching out to the communities, a joint community policing efforts that are put together in ways that the community is supporting the police. And we're getting, by the way, adequate funding for the police so that you can do that and you can have the kinds of extraordinarily good training to lower violence against people in arrest situations and other things.
Well, they should absolutely be paid more so that, number one, you get good people, and number two, they can actually live in the communities that they're supposed to serve. So many people of Armagh County Police, Charlottesville Police, they can't afford to live here because they're not making enough of a living.
It's shocking how little we are paying the police.
Would you agree, too, that one of the challenges, too, that we need to see changed is that the good police officers, the men and women in uniform, who are there for the right reason, they are absolutely good people doing a good job, they need to be heard from. They need to stand up and speak out against the bad apples who continue to make headlines and make it clear that you're not welcome here.
Well, I think many of them are, and you do have to remove the bad apples. That's clearly something that's inappropriate in a rule of law society. And but we need to get much better in both police education and citizen education in having the community understand that the police are a critical part of the success of that community and lowering the crime rate that that community totally needs, the enhanced safety.
Before we run out of time here, we did have a few more here.
Okay.
There was let's talk about the targeting disease and dealing with public health as a policy initiative. What would you like to see?
This is extremely important, and again, one of the newer ideas I would love to see seriously in the debate. We have tended in the healthcare area to focus on access to healthcare. Understandably, that's an important set of issues. But there are many other things we need to be looking at in healthcare as well, and one of the most important is the extent to which we are actually appropriately having a research budget to address the diseases themselves to try either to cure the disease in certain cases or to reduce the burden of the disease. There is a brilliant paper in the book written by Dr. Stephen Goldring, who is one of the top researchers at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York. He is formerly of the Harvard Medical faculty. And what we're looking at is there are a number of diseases in which the number of the American population that's affected is so high. The cost already paid by the government for those diseases is so high. And yet very little money is actually going into that disease process that a carefully targeted additional sort of moonshot at particular diseases one at a time, when the science shows that that's the time to do it, are things actually that have the potential to dramatically reduce the cost, to save great amounts of money to the American people, and most importantly, to let millions of Americans live without disability or pain. The one we suggested initially that fits this more than any other is the whole arthritis complex, which affects over 20 million Americans and is the greatest single source of disability in the United States of America.
I did not know that.
That's one that that cries out for this. I noticed that Hillary Clinton has just suggested that maybe we ought to be doing something like this in dealing with mental illness. I think she's absolutely right. That may well be another one that we ought to be looking at very carefully on it.
What about defense and foreign policy in a nutshell, because we only got a few minutes left? But what can you look at? What's working and what's not working?
Well, it's kind of impossible in a nutshell to address defense and foreign policy.
I know that's a tall order. But
let me just say that there are a number of things. One is we have to engage in the world. We cannot withdraw from the world.
And that's an important point, because the Republican nominee echoes the America First movement of the 1940s before the bombing of Pearl Harbor, when Charles Lindbergh and the isolationist sentiment at following World War One, that we don't want to have anything to do with anything like that ever again.
It's isolationism is completely false as a solution to our problems. And we have to be working with our allies. We have to be seriously looking at it. There are some wonderful articles in the book, one by the former director of national intelligence, one by Ambassador Crocker, who's one of our top foreign policy experts in dealing with both of those areas. But I think trying to cover that in a nutshell, obviously there's so many serious issues. ISIL is one of those. We do have to deal with ISIL. We have to deal with out-of-control adventurism by Putin these days. We have the problem of Chinese aggressiveness in the South China Sea, recently neglecting an international arbitral decision that decided against them. We have some very, very bad behavior on the part of Iran, particularly support for terrorism around the world and many other issues. And out of control, North Korea engaged in a full nuclear program. And so many, many issues. Again, the bottom line on this is look at this range, and this is only a partial range of serious national issues facing this country. And then compare that with the level of debate that we've been hearing. This is a national
disgrace. It's atrocious.
It's atrocious.
I'm reminded of Neil Postman's must-read little paperback, and I always recommend this to folks. It's I think it came out in the early 80s, Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. Absolutely must-reading, because he foresaw this. When you turn the discourse of a nation into a show, into theatrics, then people aren't able to have the conversations that are required in a democracy to control power.
Exactly.
And they will be, in turn, controlled by that power. And they will strip themselves not only of the power to control their own government, but they strip themselves of an understanding of their responsibility that they need to do so.
Exactly so. We are blessed in the United States of America, as you know so well, with the most extraordinary and wonderful founding fathers of this country that gave us an incredible system with checks and balances that, for the most part, work well. And we need basically to get with it in implementing that system and making sure that we're addressing the fundamental issues that affect the lives of every single American.
Could you do me a favor?
Sure.
Could you come back at some point? I would love to spend more time talking about the international affairs with you, which
we didn't
really have time to touch on, and we didn't even get to immigration reform. But let's set up another time and come back and really get into some of these issues around the world, and from your perspective, what needs to happen, and your experience as an ambassador dealing with other countries and their understandings and misunderstandings about America's place in the world. So let's set up another time and continue the conversation.
I'd be honored and happy to do that.
I would really look forward to that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
John Norton Moore is the Walter Brown Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. His new book is The Presidential Debates, Issues and Questions for the 2016 Elections and Beyond.